there. Have you missed me? Well, I've missed you. So, so much. I'm so excited to be back recording my favorite podcast ever. I might be a little biased, but it really is my favorite podcast. And I do want to take this time to sincerely apologize for just simply disappearing. But, you know, life do be life in sometimes. With that being said, I would like to welcome you all back to the Serial Zodiac. My name is Carly Ramsey, and I hope you guys are having the day that you deserve. Let's jump right into today's story. Warning, this episode of the Atlanta Ripper podcast contains descriptions of violent crimes, including murder and mutilation. Listener discretion is advised.
If you're a crime enthusiast, there's no way you haven't heard about Jack the Ripper, the serial killer who had practically taken over London in 1888. But what if I told you that he wasn't the only Ripper that the world has had to witness? Today, I'm about to give you the very real story of the Atlanta Ripper, the complex case of a being who murdered over 21 women in Atlanta during the 1910s. To give you a context of how things began, I'm about to take you to how Atlanta actually came into being, because all of the events are connected in ways you can't even imagine. Like, for starters, did you know that Atlanta wasn't always known as Atlanta? For a very long time during the 1800s, the city was all about the railroad. It was like the last stop on the line, so they called it Terminus. But then in 1843, things changed and the area became known as Marthasville after Governor Wilson Lemke's daughter. Fast forward a couple years and that's when the name Atlanta was born. Unlike other cities, Atlanta wasn't entirely focused on plantations and farming. Instead, it was all about the railroad and trade. And boy, was the growth crazy. The city just exploded. And in the blink of an eye, the population went from 9,000 in 1860 to a massive 22,000 in 1865. Now, even though the Civil War threw a wrench in the works, Atlanta bounced back like a champ, with cotton making coming into the picture once again and sharecropping taking off. Atlanta became the textile industry's place to be. But 1865 was an important year, because that's when the Civil War finally came to an end. Atlanta was a city that literally came out of the ashes. The residents were fully dedicated to one thing: rebuilding Atlanta to the way it used to be. And by 1900, the city was bursting at the seams with 90,000 people. No wonder why they moved the state capital from Milledgeville to Atlanta back in 1868. But here's where it gets really interesting. Atlanta wasn't just about business. It was a hotbed for civil rights action, too. People like Alonzo Herndon, the brain behind Atlanta Life Insurance Company, and Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, who helped kickstart the NAACP, were fully active at the time, trying to make Atlanta a better place. And oh, let's not forget about Booker T. Washington's famous Atlanta Compromise speech in 1895. That speech put Atlanta at the forefront of the civil rights movement. But there was one major thing that plagued Atlanta as the 1900s rolled in. Do you want to try and take a guess? Yep, it was racism. Things had gotten pretty bad, but the situation got worse in 1906. As the 1900s began, big moves were happening for civil rights in Atlanta, which was awesome. I mean, it truly seemed like Atlanta was healing from all that war and violence, moving in a better direction. But turns out that changing minds was a whole different ballgame. Atlanta was booming, which meant jobs were getting lesser and lesser with every passing day. And both Black and white residents of Atlanta were scraping for them. On top of that, the Black upper class was growing, which ticked off some people who were still stuck in the past. In theory, the people of Atlanta had moved past the Civil War, but it's never easy to unlearn the ways of the past, is it? Things got rough when in 1906, an election rolled around. Hoke Smith, who used to run the Atlanta Journal, and Clark Howell, the hotshot editor of the Atlanta Constitution, stepped into the scene. And whatever message they had was like fuel to the fire. Their backwards talk made things significantly worse in Atlanta. Couple it with the fact that local newspapers had reported 4 assaults on white women in Atlanta, all of which were unsubstantiated. Now, who would they have pointed the fingers at? Of course, the Black people, without even a shred of proof. News spread pretty fast, and thousands of white men got together, ready to destroy anything that came their way. Next thing you know, there was a full-blown race riot in September. Mayor Woodward tried to calm the chaos, but it was like trying to put out a fire with a water gun. Things were so out of hand that white men were fighting Black men on the streets, smashing up Black-owned businesses, and it went on for 4 days straight. Plus, hundreds of Black men, women, and children fled the city fearing for their lives. It was total madness. And they had to call in the state military to try to restore some order. But by then, the damage was done. According to Jeffrey Wells, who wrote the Atlanta Ripper, somewhere between 24 to 40 African Americans lost their lives in the chaos. It was like the city was torn apart at the seams. But as hopeless as the riot was, something good came out of it. The African American community in Atlanta realized that they needed to stick together, so they decided to join hands and look out for each other. This would help them make sure nothing was hurting them and that their interest would not be overlooked, no matter what the situation was. But just 4 years after this riot, mysterious things began to happen. The dead body of Maggie Brooke, a 23-year-old Black woman, was discovered on October 3rd, 1910. She was working as a cook and her skull had been cracked open. It was a horrific case, but nobody knew that this was the beginning of something much more sinister. A few months down the line, on January 22nd, 1911, they stumbled upon Rosa Trice's body, not far from her house. Not only was she also a Black woman, but her case was even worse. Her skull was bashed in, her throat slashed, and she'd been stabbed in the jaw. Her husband got arrested for it, but he walked free later because they didn't have enough proof, according to the Atlanta Constitution. Making a connection between Rosa and Maggie's murders was hard, especially because they were quite a few months apart. But then another dead body of a Black woman emerged into the scene. This woman was about 25 years old, with her head crushed in the woods. Then, on May 27th, 1911, Mary Bell Walker was found dead. This happened when she left her job as a cook at a house down Cooper Street and was walking to her home. The next morning, her sister woke up to find her empty bed, leading to a panicked search of the property. Eventually, they found Belle in an old field with a jagged cut across her throat. While nobody at this point knew what was going on, this was the beginning of the doings of a man who would soon become known as the Atlanta Ripper. How he got his name is a whole different story, and if you stick around for a while, you'll find out why. There was a shift in Atlanta's understanding of what was going on with one particular murder. Addie Watts' lifeless body was found near the Southern Railway, her head crushed by a train coupling pin. It was a savage end to a life, as her throat was slashed before being dragged to the tracks. It was Addie's death that made people start to wonder if there was some serial killer out there targeting young Black women. The one thing that stood out was that most of these killings went down in the old 4th Ward of the city, where the streets were dimly lit and there weren't many streetcars around. Giving the killer the perfect cover of darkness to do his dirty work. But who were all these women? Yes, they were Black, but there was something else that connected them. Well, a lot of these victims were actually working as domestic servants for white people in the old 4th Ward and nearby spots. Imagine, one attack even happened just down the street from where one of those girls worked. Her boss heard the chaos, rushed out for help, but sadly couldn't catch the killer. Plus, they often found the dead bodies near the railroad tracks. But on July 1st, 1911, things began to change. 40-year-old Lena Sharp was killed, but this was one of the rare cases where the murderer had a witness. What happened was that Lena's daughter, Emma Lou, got worried when her mom didn't come home from the market, especially since their neighbor, Addie Watts, was murdered just weeks before. Emma Lou went searching and ran into this tall guy who said, "Don't worry, I never hurt girls like you," right before stabbing her in the back. Emma's screams pierced through the air, alerting the people around her, and soon a search party sprang into action. They scoured every nook and cranny until they stumbled upon Lena Sharp's lifeless body near the Seaboard Railroad tracks. Lena's throat was slashed, wide open, blood pooling around her head. The brutality was so horrifying that even the undertaker put up a $25 bounty to catch the Manic responsible for the slaughter. But there are some conflicting stories about what went down with Lena Sharp and her daughter, Emmalou. According to the Atlanta Journal, they were out for a stroll when this black guy suddenly attacked Lena with a brick and then stabbed Emmalou when she tried to run. According to them, the killer even sliced Lena's throat before coming back for Emmalou, who had passed out but woke up just in time to see him standing over her with a knife. Then, there's another version of the story where both Lena and Emma were attacked separately. Emmalou managed to describe the killer as a tall, skinny black man in both cases. Todd Henderson was a man who emerged when Emmalou Sharp identified him as her potential assailant. Suspicion further mounted against Henderson when he was spotted with Sadie Holly the night she was killed. And a shoe print found at the crime scene matched his footwear. In the beginning, Emma was uncertain about whether Todd was the right man or not. She said that he was the one to the best of her knowledge. But once she heard him speak, her mind changed. She had a visceral reaction upon hearing Henderson's voice, a reported shriek, which suggested a deep-seated fear or recognition. Furthermore, a corroborating account from the local clerk found Henderson near the crime scene. However, amidst the mounting circumstantial evidence, Henderson vehemently maintained his innocence, offering explanations for his whereabouts that evening. He pointed to his residency in the area as a justification for his frequent appearances near the crime scenes. In a peculiar twist, Henderson even suggested an alternative target for his hypothetical homicidal urges, which was his wife. This cast doubt on the validity of his alibi, but the unsettling fact remained, several of the Ripper's victims met their gruesome fate near Henderson's house, fueling suspicions amongst investigators. Adding complexity to the case were conflicting testimonies that led to even more uncertainty. While some witnesses placed Henderson at the scene of Sadie Holly's murders, others implicated Henry Huff, raising doubts about the veracity of eyewitness accounts. However, a damning piece of evidence emerged against Henderson. Despite his denial of owning a razor, police uncovered his visit to a local barbershop for razor sharpening on the day after Holly's murder. Ultimately, Henderson found himself behind bars, charged with the murder of Sadie Holly, but he eluded accountability for the deaths of Lena Sharp and the other victims. Soon, he was also let go, because even when he was behind bars, the killings continued. The entire ordeal was quite horrifying, but it was impossible to make sense of what was going on and how media owned by white people sensationalized the entire thing. It was almost like entertainment for them. While on the other side, the black community of Atlanta was in shambles. Now, amid all this chaos, Pastor Henry Hugh Proctor from the First Congregational Church in Atlanta stepped up. He rallied black leaders to team up and hunt down this lunatic. They even pushed the cops to hire black detectives, thinking they might have better luck getting information from black people in the area. But instead of getting better, things simply continued to get worse. In July of 1911, Mary Udell, a cook of the Seltzer House, narrowly escaped a close encounter with death. As she was walking home one night, she heard a whistle, and turning, she spotted a tall, broad man lurking in the shadows. Terrified, she fled to safety, alerting Mr. Seltzer, who bravely confronted the assailant, only for him to slip away into the night. On July 11th, 1911, at the break of dawn, Will Broglin made a grisly discovery on his way to work. He noticed signs of a struggle in the bush, and when he dared to find out what it was about, here's what he found. Sadie Holly's mutilated body lying in the dirt with her throat slit from ear to ear and her head smashed in with a rock. The killer's tracks vanished into thin air, leaving behind a trail of terror. Despite being in the Ripper's sights, Sadie became the first victim to make headlines in the Atlanta Constitution. The whole town went into a frenzy, fearing for their lives. And this was when the panic truly set in. It seemed like the murders would never stop. Soon after Sadie's murder, the police arrested 27-year-old Henry Huff under the suspicion of being the Atlanta Ripper. He was a laborer, and what's intriguing is that the witnesses claimed to have seen him with Holly on the fateful night she met her demise. When arrested, Huff's trousers were stained with dirt and blood, and he had scratches on his arms. But here's the twist. Despite his arrest and subsequent trial, the Ripper's reign of terror persisted, with the murders escalating in brutality. Eventually, Huff was acquitted of Holly's murder, leaving investigators back at square one. Just a month later, on August 31st of 1911, they found 20-year-old Mary Ann Duncan lying near the railroad tracks with her throat slashed. But it wasn't the end of it. The bodies of Eva Florence and Minnie Wise also popped up later that same year. But it was Mary Putnam's death that stood out as one of the most gruesome murders that unfolded during that time. On a cold November evening in 1911, the city woke up to Mary Putnam's lifeless body, hastily buried under loose dirt near Stewart Street and the Beltline. Mary's throat and breast had been slashed, but here's the most morbid part of it all. Her heart was torn out, and her body was disemboweled. The scene was nightmarish, but the killer left behind a clue. Handprints in the dirt around the body, making his signature. The trail led investigators 200 yards before abruptly vanishing at the car line. Mary's cause of death was a broken skull and lacerated throat ring, which confirmed that the Atlanta Ripper didn't just want to kill. He was brutal with the way that he killed these poor women.
As the Ripper's terror continued, the police found themselves at a loss, unable to catch the elusive killer. The community banded together, offering rewards for the capture of the fiend, desperate for justice. With each murder bearing eerie similarities, Atlanta was convinced it was dealing with a lone serial killer. However, in a twist of events, a grand jury concluded that each murder was committed by different African-American men, citing jealousy following immoral conduct as the motive. Yet, they failed to explain how they reached this verdict, leaving more questions than answers. Refusing to acknowledge the existence of the Atlanta Ripper as anything more than a myth, authorities continued to arrest different Black men for the crimes, but convictions remained elusive due to the lack of concrete evidence. The reason the name the Atlanta Ripper sounds so familiar is that this wasn't the first time the word Ripper was associated with a serial killer. In 1888, London's Whitechapel district, a mysterious figure emerged from the shadows, who later became known as the notorious Jack the Ripper. This serial killer prowled the impoverished area, targeting women employed as prostitutes. He was chillingly consistent with whom he chose to kill and how. He would slash their throats and mutilate abdomens, leaving a trail of horror in the grimy East End alleys. Rumors swirled that the Ripper possessed surgical expertise, given the precision with which he extracted organs from his victims. With each new murder, the panic escalated, fueled by a barrage of letters claiming to be from the killer himself. But it was the Dear Boss letter, likely a concoction by journalists seeking to sensationalize the story, that named him Jack the Ripper and sent shockwaves through the press. Another missive and ominous From Hell letter, accompanied by a preserved human kidney, only added to the frenzy. Media coverage soared, sending the Ripper into international infamy. Despite an exhaustive police investigation into the series of 11 brutal slayings spanning Whitechapel and Spitalfields from 1888 to 1891, including the infamous Canonical Five victims, including Mary Ann Knowles, Ann Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes, and Mary Jane Kelly, the case remained a mystery. Just a little over two decades later, a series of killings began in Atlanta, and by that time, Jack the Ripper's influence hadn't left the world. There were several similarities between the two. Both of them targeted vulnerable women, mostly those who were outcasts within society. Plus, both of these killers had certain patterns that they would follow in their killings. And because of the brutal nature of the Atlanta Ripper's crimes, he was connected directly with Jack the Ripper. The name was emphasized when, while reporting the deaths, local newspapers would refer to the mysterious serial killer as the Atlanta Ripper. Despite all the arrests that were made, the Atlanta Ripper was unfazed. Whether it was the work of a lone killer or a sinister network of copycats, the murders continued until 1914, when Mary Rowland was found dead. It is believed that she was the Ripper's last victim, and to this day, nobody knows about the true identity of the Atlanta Ripper. But the influence of the Atlanta Ripper lasted years after the killings had stopped. When Zela Favors was discovered on her porch, battered and bruised, fighting for her life, the whole neighborhood was shook. She had multiple wounds and her head was brutally bashed in. Rushed to the hospital, her chances looked slim. Witnesses recall seeing her earlier chatting with a stranger who ominously mentioned, "Jack the Ripper ain't dead yet." Tracing a trail of blood from their conversation to her doorstep, investigators were left reeling. But amid the chaos of those turbulent times, where segregation and racism loomed large, the plight of the Atlanta Ripper's victims often went unnoticed. While these grisly murders unfolded, the media was preoccupied with reporting on robberies in the wealthier, predominantly white neighborhoods. With limited resources and forensic technology, law enforcement faced an uphill battle in solving these crimes. Yet, as the decades passed, the truth behind these heinous acts remained elusive, haunting the collective conscience of the South. Over 100 years later, the mystery persists, a reminder of the region's troubled past. Yet, in the face of such darkness, there's a glimmer of hope, a belief that justice, though delayed, will eventually prevail. Do you think that the Atlanta Ripper was just one person or several people scheming to create chaos in society? Let me know what you're thinking, and don't forget to like and subscribe for more. Until next time, my name is Carly, and this is the Serial Zodiac. Bye!